Hi there, my name is Dimitri, and in this screencast I want to show you all the new features that are available in C Sharp 7 with the release of Visual Studio 2017. So here's what we're going to talk about. We'll take a look at out variables, pattern matching, tuples, local functions, ref returns and locals, expression body members, throw expressions, generalized async return types, and we'll take a look at the literal improvements as well. We'll begin our exploration of C Sharp 7 features with a look at the new out variable mechanic. Now, the out variables are typically used when you need to return more than one value from a method. So you have one return value by using return, but you can have additional return values using out parameters. So suppose you want to parse a datetime from a string, you have to declare the datetime dt, and then you say if I am able to parse, so I can try parsing a particular value, like let's say January 1st, 2017, I can try parsing it and I can put it into the variable dt. And if in fact this operation succeeds, then for example, I can write line dt, for example. So this is completely legal, and this is the way that it's been done before C Sharp 7. Now, one thing you'll notice is that we have the variable declaration. So you have to declare the variable, and then you use the variable as an out parameter. Well, in C Sharp 7, the variable declaration is actually an expression and not a statement. And what you can do is you can stick an out variable declaration right inside the try parse call. So you can write something like the following. You can say datetime.tryParse, and here we'll have February 2nd, 2016, for example. And here we can fuse both the variable declaration, which is what's happening here, as well as its use as an out parameter, which is what's happening here. So I can say out date time DT2. And of course, I can use DT2 inside the scope here. But in addition, and this is interesting, the DT2 variable is actually available in the outer scope as well. So it's not constrained to the block where it was being used. What I can do is I can write line DT2 dot and then get code completion and use dt2.hour here, for example. So dt2 is not constrained in scope to just the if statement. It's also available outside the if statement. Now, one interesting thing that you can do instead of putting the full variable type here is you can use var, because it's obvious from the function signature that we're expecting a datetime, so you don't have to specify the datetime here. It's a bit redundant to do so in actual fact. And finally, I wanted to mention what happens if the parse actually fails, because as I said, DT2 will be available here whether or not we actually manage to parse something into it. So the question might be, well, what if the parsing fails in this particular case? For example, if I do int parse and I try to parse ABC, which is obviously not an integer, and I put it in an out variable called I, what is the actual result? So if I do a try parse like this and I then write line the value of I, what I'm going to get, as you can see here, is I'm getting zero. So in the case where parsing fails, I'm getting the default value for that particular type. So in this case, it's an integer which has a default value of zero. If it was Boolean, I would get a false. And if it was a reference type, I would obviously get a null. Pattern matching is another feature that's coming to C Sharp. Unfortunately, it's coming very slowly, and in C Sharp 7, we don't really get that many features of pattern matching. We're certainly not approaching the status of the F Sharp language where you do pattern matching on algebraic types. We don't have anything like this in C Sharp 7, but we do have a couple of interesting features for mainly switching on the different types. So let's imagine that we have a bit of a hierarchy going on. So let's suppose we have geometric shape. So I have a base class called shape. Then I have a class called rectangle, which inherits from shape. And in addition, I'm going to have a circle class, which will also inherit from shape. So here is my circle, which is a shape. I'm going to add some members to the rectangle. So maybe public int width and height, like so. Now let us suppose that we need some sort of way of actually displaying a shape. So we might have some sort of method called displayShape, although that has to be in a class, so let's put it in here. So we have a method called displayShape, make it a static method, and we might be taking a shape. Now, one of the typical concerns in development is how do you figure out the type of the shape? And typically, the ways in which we did it in C Sharp 7 and earlier are either using the is keyword or using the as keyword. So one of the options is you just say if shape is rectangle, then what you do is you say var rc and you cast the shape to a rectangle. So you say rectangle shape and then you do rc dot, you know, width, height, whatever. So you can use it as a rectangle. Another way is when you say var rect equals shape as rectangle, and then you get a null if it's not a rectangle. So you say if rect, you can do it like this, rect not null. So if rect is not equal to null, then rectangle is obviously valid and you can proceed to work with it. Now in C# 7, you actually kind of fuse the is and as operations, and as a result, you can write the following. You can say if shape is rectangle R. So in this case, you both check that the shape is a rectangle, and if it is a rectangle, you assign the variable R. So this is a brand new way of actually casting things, and it's available both in the if statement as well as the switch statement. Now, before I go to the switch statement, let me show you that it is in fact possible to do somewhat silly things like do a not in front of it. So you can say if not shape is circle, not circle. So this is a bit counterintuitive, of course, because when you've checked if something is not a circle, it could still be one of many elements in the hierarchy. So I don't know the usefulness of having a not here, but it is possible to do this because this whole thing evaluates to a Boolean, so you can do a not in front, however silly that may be. So essentially, in addition to having the if statement, you can do a switch. So we can, for example, say switch on shape, and here we have some new possibilities as well. So one possibility, of course, is checking for the type. So if I want to find a circle, I can say case circle C. So what this does is it lets you switch not on shape itself, but on the type of shape. And if shape is in fact a circle, then the variable C now refers to a circle, and you can use C for whatever reason you want, and then obviously do a break at the end. Now, in addition to being able to make a case for a rectangle, what you can do is even more sophisticated. You can say case rectangle SQ colon, and in addition, without the colon, you can specify that you want the width equal to the height. So you're looking for rectangles where the width is equal to the height, and it, just like in the F# programming language, you can write when and write a condition. So you can say when sq.height is equal to sq.width, and then you put a colon, and once again, you're operating on a rectangle where the height and the width are identical, so you can operate on this particular square, and then, of course, do a break at the end. Now, unfortunately, one of the things we didn't get, and I'm jumping ahead here, is we didn't get any kind of switching on the new tuples, for example. So if I say something like var z equals 1223, I cannot then go ahead and switch, for example, on a case, let's say case 00. So I cannot switch on z and say case 00. We are at the origin. So none of that goodness that exists in F#, partly due to algebraic types, none of that is available in C# yet, but I'm hoping that it will be available in the later versions. Now let's talk about tuples. Now, as I'm sure you know, tuples have already existed inside the C# base class library as a purely library solution without any kind of change to C# syntax. It was essentially a bunch of different types with a varying number of generic parameters. Now, we don't have variadic templates in C#, so it was a way of defining maybe up to 8 or 9 variables, something like that, a kind of static tuple where you don't really have to do much in order to actually get the functionality. But once you had the functionality of tuples, people quickly realized it wasn't as good as it might have been. So let me show you why. Let us suppose, for example, that you want to have a function which returns both the sum and the product of two values. So typically in the kind of pre-C# 7 days, you would make a function which would return a tuple of two double values. So these double values, and we will call this sum and product, and you will take double A and double B, and you would simply return tuple.create with A plus B and A times B. So that was the old-fashioned way, and this works just fine. So you can say var sp equals sum and product with the values 2 and 5, for example, and we can certainly write line, but here is where the fun ends, because in order to show the sum, you basically have to say sp.item1, And for the product, you have to use sp.item2. So these item 1, item 2, and so on, they generally limit the usability of the library-based tuple approach quite a bit because you don't really know which one is the sum and the product. Well, maybe you know for this particular invocation, but if you have many elements of a tuple, how do you know what they correspond to? They don't have any names. This was actually a problem in the F-sharp algebraic types as well, and they fixed it in F-sharp, and since C-sharp 7, they fixed it here as well. So how did they fix it exactly? Well, they fixed it by introducing an entirely different kind of tuple type. So let's write a new sum and product, which will be a bit nicer. So it's going to be a static function which returns two double values. And to define the brand new tuple, you simply put a type list in round brackets. That's pretty much it. And we'll call it new sum and product. And once again, we'll take double A and double B. And this time round, we're going to return. And once again, using round brackets, we'll return A plus B and A times B. So this is it. This is how you initialize the new tuples. But notice that something is wrong here. You can see the red wavy underlines right next to the tuple, and it's telling us that system.valueTuple is not resolved. And this is a major blunder that Microsoft has done. So despite releasing the brand new .NET Framework 4.6.2, they actually neglected to add the type which makes this tuple functionality possible into the .NET Framework. Now, this is quite a surprising thing. However, at the moment, at the time of writing, at the time of release of Microsoft Visual Studio 2017, what you have to do in order to get this functionality is you have to add an external nugget package. That's right. In order to use a core language feature, you really have to go into the Nugget store and you have to go looking for value tuples. So you have to install this package in order to be able to actually use the tuples. So now that we've installed the required tuple, you can see that the red wavy underlines has gone away, but we still haven't solved the principal problem, which is the problem of naming the tuple elements. Let's actually get the new tuple, let's use it, and let's see what we get. So I would say var sp2 equals new sum and product with values 2 and 5 again. And this time round, if we want to right line the sum, at the moment, if I go ahead and I call this sp2, I can go and say sp2 dot, and I'm still getting item 1 and item 2, which is a bit disappointing. However, what we can do is we can add the names of the tuple elements right in the function signature. So here I can call the first argument sum, and I can call the second argument product. And now if we look at code completion for sp2, once again, you can see that we now have product and sum. Although strictly speaking, if you wanted to use item 1 and item 2, these are actually available. So these still exist and you can actually find them inside the element. However, they're not shown in code completion. So you might be wondering, well, why is that? Well, obviously it's so that you use the names which have been defined for this tuple because that makes more sense. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to refer to them as sum here and then product sp2.product as well. Luckily, we get them in code completion. Now, if you wanted to, you could, of course, go ahead and get them as sp2.item1 and item2 respectively. So you still have that possibility, but it's kind of hidden away because that's not how the new tuples are intended to be used. Finally, let's right line the actual type of sp2 so that we can take a look at what we're actually getting here. All right, so here is the output. You can see that we're getting the same results whether we use the new or the old approach. You can see that we're also able to reference item 2 directly. And here, finally, the type of the element that we've just created is system value tuple. It's a generic type with two arguments of type double and double. So this value tuple is what makes all the magic possible. It behaves in a similar way to an ordinary tuple, the difference being that this extra piece of syntactic sugar and this extra syntax with the round brackets is now possible, and it is precisely this piece of syntax which gives you a value tuple. Now, strictly speaking, it is possible to start using value tuple directly if you wanted to, although that's really not recommended. So for example, I can make a value tuple with two double values and call it VT, and I will assign SP2 to VT. Now, the thing is, if you try to get some item from VT, you can no longer say, for example, VT.sum, because you've lost all the information in that particular type, because only SP2 actually knows about the results and the names of the variables that are being used inside the tuple. So here you can keep using item 1 and item 2 and so on, but that has very little value to your development, and you may as well have stuck with the old tuple if that's what you want to do. Now, in addition to being able to store the tuple in a variable of its own type, what you can also do is you can store the parts of the tuple in their own separate variables. So what I can do is I can write var sum, product, and I can say that this is the result of an invocation of new sum and product with values 1 and 2, for example. Now, there's actually two varieties of syntax. This is interesting. So this is one variety, and the other variety is where you specify the types explicitly. So you can also say double S and double P, for example, equals new sum and product 2 and 3. So let's sort of consider the differences here. So in the first case, you're explicitly specifying the types as well as the names of the variables that you want to assign from a particular tuple. And of course, SS and PP, they're not special types, they're just doubles. So it's like a variable declaration repeated multiple times for different variables, and the tuple that you get on the right-hand side gets unpacked into these variables. Now, the second approach basically lets you infer the type. So you cannot put a double in here. That's actually not valid. You can see that there is a problem here. So you cannot do this kind of conversion. But if you use var and just put the names of the variables in a list, then that's completely legal. And it actually, once again, unpacks the tuple that you get as a result of this function invocation into the variables sum and product, respectively. And their types are, of course, inferred from the return result. Now, this is, of course, a variable declaration, but if you wanted to, you could prepare the variables in advance and then simply unpack them into variables that have already been declared. So, for example, I can write double S, P, so I declare the variables, and then I can say S, P equal new sum and product with values 1 and 2. So this is also legal as well. Now, so far, we've looked at names of tuples inside the signature. Well, we can also create tuples with member names right inside our code, right inside our main method. So, for example, if I want to describe myself, I could do it with a tuple. So here I can say that my name is Dimitri, and seeing how I'm immortal, my age is actually 123. So this is an example of making a tuple in place where you specify the members, name and age. And then, of course, I can write line me, and this would also do pretty output of the whole tuple. Or I can write line me.type so that we can see what actually type is getting. So that we can see what kind of type actually gets created. So let's execute this. And as you can see, here is the pretty print of the tuple. And here, once again, the type of the tuple is value tuple, but this time with members of type string and in 32. And of course, I can always use the tuple members. So for example, I can say my name is me.name. As you can see, I'm getting code completion here. And I am me.age years old, like so. And we can execute this as well. And we get my name is Dimitri. I am 123 years old. Now, tuples are usable in any place where ordinary types are used. So for example, you can make a func right inside this main method. I can say var snp equals new func double double. And it returns, let's say, double comma double. And here I can specify a lambda, so I can say a comma b goes to, and here, once again, using round brackets, I can specify that the sum is a plus b and the product is a times b. Now, unfortunately, in this particular setup, in the setup that I've created, getting actual members is difficult. So if you simply add it to the signature, If you say double sum and double product like this, you're not going to be able to get them in the signature. So let me get rid of this for now. So if I have this lambda here, which returns a plus b and a times b, and I get some result, so I say var result equals snp with values 1 and 2, and I look at result dot, just the code completion, you can see that I am getting the members here. I'm getting the product and the sum, and I can sort of use them. So for example, I can write line that the sum is equals to result.sum. Now this is fine, and I can execute this, and here is my sum of 3. However, if I instead decide to keep it in the declaration, so if I get rid of sum here and product here, and I add sum here and product here, this is obviously not propagated outside of the actual lambda, and so I am unable to use result.sum anymore, and I have to stick to things like item 1 and item 2. Now you're probably wondering, well, if these names are nothing more than pieces of syntactic sugar, do they actually make it into the intermediate language? And the answer is both yes and no. So certainly when you reference sp2.product, you're really referencing sp2.item2. There is no product name anywhere inside. However, if you have pieces of public API which use tuples, which include names like sum and product, for example, then these are in fact preserved inside of the IL. Now, how is it done? Well, let me show you. Here is .peek, and I've opened the C# demos project, so we can go all the way to the appropriate function. So we'll take a look at new sum and product. We'll go to decompiled sources, and you will see one particular piece of magic which actually makes everything possible. And here it is, precisely this line. So as you can see, this function new sum and product, it returns a new value tuple of double double. So it doesn't look as though sum and product names are preserved until you look at this attribute. So this attribute tells us that the return value actually has specific tuple element names. So as you can see, it's a bit of a hack in terms of getting the names of the tuple exported, but it is enough for things like the IDE to help you figure out what the code completion is, for example. So here we're decorating the tuple element names, and we're saying that the tuple which we're returning, which is just two doubles, so it's item 1 and item 2, actually has specific names like sum and product. But if you look at the code down below, you will see that all the references to the different members actually continue to use things like item 1 and item 2 all over the place. So whenever you actually write .sum or .product, the compiler replaces it by item 1, item 2, and so on and so forth. With the coming of tuples, C# has included yet another piece of functionality called deconstruction. And this piece of functionality is obviously useful for tuples. So for example, here I have a tuple consisting of a string and an int. And what I can do is I can take that tuple and I can use this kind of variable declaration to deconstruct the tuple into two variables, name, which is a string, and age, which is an int. Now, interestingly enough, the deconstruction functionality isn't limited to tuples. So you don't have to use tuples if you want to use deconstruction. Instead, you can use any of your own types and support deconstruction functionality in them. So let me give you an example. Let's suppose you make a class point. Let's suppose this class point has two public fields x and y. Now let us suppose that somewhere in your code you want to write something like var x comma y equals my point, where my point is a point. So if you have var my point equals new point, and you want to deconstruct that point into variables x and y. Now, even though at the moment we don't have any red wavy underlines, if you try to compile it, you're going to get a rather peculiar kind of error. You're going to get an error saying that you cannot infer the type of implicitly typed deconstruction variable x. Now, even if you change it to an int, for example, that's still not going to help, because the second problem is the one that's really killing you. Point does not have a definition for deconstruct. So deconstruct is yet another function which is used as a piece of syntactic sugar. So what you can do is you can specify that the point type is deconstructible into two out variables. So here what I can do is I can say public void deconstruct, and I can deconstruct the point into out variables int x, and out int y. And here, of course, it's a simple process of copying. So I say x equals big X, y equals big Y. And now all of a sudden, the entire process of deconstruction actually becomes valid. And now we know that x and y are of type int, and we can start using them. So we can start right-lighting things like, for example, the x value here. So this kind of approach of deconstruction works whenever you want to use a particular type inside this kind of multivariable declaration. That's what I would call it. Now, in addition, if you don't care about some part of this multivariable declaration, like for example, you're deconstructing a point, but you don't really care about the y value, you can see it grayed out here, you can replace it with an underscore, and the underscore indicates a kind of do not care value. So this is yet another language feature. So if you don't care about a particular value that's being deconstructed as part of a bunch of values, just put an underscore in there instead, and it will just be ignored. Local functions are yet another welcome feature in C#, but to be honest, that feature already existed in C#, just in a different guise. So once again, we got some extra convenience out of that feature. So let me show you how local functions would work before C# 7, and then we'll take a look at how they work right now. Now, let's suppose I want to have some equation solver class, and I want to solve different kinds of equations, like for example, quadratic equations. So what I can do is I can write a public static function which returns a tuple of two double values. Here I think we can get away with using an ordinary tuple, and it's called solve quadratic, and it would take double A, double B, and double C. So I want to solve a quadratic equation, and part of solving the quadratic equation is calculating the discriminant, which is quite simply b squared minus 4ac. Now, where do we want to calculate it? So up until now, we've had several options for how you can actually calculate the discriminant. So for example, kind of a very simple option, I could just declare a func within this particular function. So I could say var calculate discriminant, like so, and I could say that's going to be a new func taking three doubles and returning a double as well. And here I could provide the actual lambda. So once again, we get some code completion here. So I would take the arguments. I cannot use the names A, B, and C. So I would call them typically A, B, B, and C, C. And as a result, I would return AA, well, BB times BB minus 4 times AA times CC, something like that. So that's one possibility. It's rather lengthy because you have to have the full signature for the function, but this does work. So you have this calculate discriminant, you say var disk equals calculate discriminant with the values A, B, and C. And then of course you can use that. So you can return, you can calculate the square root of the discriminant. So root disk equals math.sqrt of the discriminant, and then you return tuple.create, and you solve the quadratic equation like we all have done at school. So minus b plus root disk divided by 2a, and then the same but with the minus sign here. Well, let's put it up on top. Here is the minus and here is the plus. We can actually start using this API. I just want to show that it works. So var result equals equation solver dot solve quadratic with 1, 10, and 16, for example, not forgetting the commas between the arguments, and then I can right line the result, and we can see that the solution does in fact work. So here's the output, minus 8 and minus 2, but this is a rather convoluted way of putting a function inside a function. So what else can we do? Well, we can obviously put the function outside, in the sense that we can just go ahead here and we can make a private static double function called calculate discriminant, or we can take double A, double B, and double C, and we can return B times B minus 4 times A times C, like so. We can even turn it into an expression body if that's what we want to do. However, the problem is, even though it's private, it's still kind of polluting the internal code completion. So now, for example, we have it in any kind of member of equation solver, whether we want it or not. And maybe this function pertains only to quadratic equations. So what can we do? Well, with C#7, what we can do is we can declare the function right inside the body. So let's take a look at the ways in which this can be done. So one of the ways is you say double calculate discriminant. You take the arguments. Once again, you cannot double the names, so double AA, double BB, and double CC, and you return BB squared minus 4 times A times C, like so. So this is, of course, completely valid, and this is the new C# 7 way of having functions inside functions, and then we can just use this function and be happy that it works. Now, in addition, what we can do is we can have this function also capture A, B, and C as if it were a lambda, because remember, lambda functions, they can capture whatever it is that's available in their scope. So here, to calculate the discriminant, we can actually do it differently. So let's comment this out. What we can do is we can say double calculate discriminant and give it no arguments and simply return B times B minus 4 times A times C, because now what we're doing is we're capturing the values which are available right inside of the outer method. So I can get rid of these arguments, and this is once again a completely valid solution to the problem. So if we would rather prefer to capture things from the arguments, then this is completely legitimate. Now, in terms of the placement rules for inner functions, they are the same as if we were in a class instead of a method. So in addition to being able to refactor this to the expression body, I can do a particularly unpleasant thing and cut this function and place it after the actual return statement, and this is also completely valid. So the scope rules for functions are that you can place them anywhere, which makes it a bit inconvenient, because you look at calculated discriminant and you only realize that it's actually defined later than where it's being used. This is particularly difficult if you're used to C++ like me, where you want the function to be declared before you're actually using it. And this is pretty much the gist of how local functions work in C# 7. One new extra feature that C# 7 brings to the table is an ability to make references to local variables. Now, this becomes a bit of a strange situation, and let me show you how. So the idea is as follows. Let's suppose I have an array with a bunch of numbers. Let's say I have 1, 2, 3. Now, what I can do is I can make a reference variable, which instead of simply stores the value from one of these elements of the array, it actually refers to that value. So you can think of it like a pointer or a reference if you're familiar with C++. So here it is. I make ref int reference to the second value in the array by saying ref numbers at 1. So what this implies is that ref to second is now referencing the variable stored here, and as a result, any changes to ref to second affect the second element of the array. So for example, I can grab this value, obviously, I can say value of second equals ref to second, so that simply copies the value, but I can also assign the value, so I can say ref to second equals 123, and if I right line the value, so for example, I'm going to write the entire array, so I'll just string dot join with a comma here, get all the numbers in. If I actually execute this, you can see that we have an array consisting of 1, 123, and 3, because this second value was modified through a reference to that second value of the array. Now, there are a couple of rules to how references work. First of all, you cannot rebind a reference. So once you're referencing something, once you're referencing, let's say, the second element of the array, you cannot go ahead and reference something else. So I cannot say ref to second equals ref numbers at 0. This is invalid, and C# doesn't support this kind of notation. So you cannot rebind a reference. Now, in addition, you can do quite silly things with references, because this reference that I've just made, it's going to persist even if the array is actually resized and the array element is no longer available. So what I can do is I can say array.resize, and I can resize the array numbers to have just a single element. So now the array kind of stops here, but we still get a reference to the second element of the array, and we can actually manipulate this. So what I can do, I can write line, for example, that the second element is, and use ref to second. So I can do this, and I can also say array size is numbers.length, and we can take a look at what we're actually getting in this case. So here, if I execute this, you can see that I'm still getting the second element, even though the element isn't actually part of the array. So one would expect the element to be cleaned up somehow, and yet it's still here with a reference. And I can keep manipulating this reference, so I can say ref2second equals 3 to 1, for example. And then once again, if I write line, predictably enough, I still get the value 3 to 1, even though the array is still only one element in size. Now, of course, if I go ahead and I start using it a different way, like for example, if I try to set the value of the first element in the array, either directly or by using the API. So for example, if I say something like numbers.setValue 3 to 1 to element 1, I am, of course, going to get an exception in this case because I'm accessing beyond the end of the array. But when you use a reference, nobody seems to be checking that. So it's a kind of hack in a way. Now here is where things turn a bit sour, because you might be wanting to use these references with list, for example, but it's not going to work. So if I have a number list with a couple of elements, once again, let's make a list of integers. The values 1, 2, and 3, I cannot make a reference to an element in this list. So if I say ref in second equals ref number list at position 1, I cannot do it. You can see that the error I'm getting here is that the ref argument must be an assignment variable field or array element. So there is a constraint in terms of where that feature is actually applicable. And obviously lists and more complicated constructs are not it. And this is particularly sad because you might want to reference a character in a string, for example, because that character is referred to with an indexer, you cannot actually get to it, which is rather sad. So these are local references. How about references which are being used and in fact returned from functions? So let me show you a very simple example of a function where we pass an array and the element to find, and we return the index of that element. So a very simple function. So here it is. We say static ref int, so it returns an integer reference. The function is going to be called find. It will take an array which is a bunch of numbers and also the value that we want to find. And so far, the actual operation of the array is very simple. You simply iterate through all the elements in the array. So go through numbers.length, and inside here, if numbers at position I is what you're looking for, then you can return a reference. So you return ref to the element in the array at position I. So this is how you can return a reference to an element within the array from a method. And now the question is, well, what if you haven't found the element? What exactly do you return? Now, typically you would return like -1 or something, but unfortunately in this case with the ref, you have no option of returning a -1 or some sort of int minimum value or something. You cannot return -1 because that is quite simply a local value. You simply, if you compile it, you can see that by value returns can only be used in methods that return by value. You're obviously returning by reference, so that's not going to work. And another thing which will not work is trying to make it local. So if you say int fail equals -1 and you return ref fail, the compiler isn't stupid. It's going to realize that you're trying to return a local reference, and it's going to say cannot return local fail by reference because it's not a ref local. So that's not going to work either. So what is going to work? Well, throwing an exception might work. So we can throw a new argument exception and give it some message like meh, for example, and that is how you would handle this kind of situation. So here is the function. Now let's take a look at how to actually consume the function. So I will make more numbers, int more numbers, and I would make 10, 20, and 30. And here what I can do is I can get a ref int reference to 30 by using the find function. So to get a reference to 30, I do ref find. Notice you also have to put a ref in front of whatever it is that you're invoking as a ref. So here I would specify more numbers, and the value I'm looking for is 30. And then of course I can manipulate this reference. So I can say ref to 30 equals 1000, for example, and that would actually change the value. So we can actually look at more numbers. I will once again write line string.join with a comma. I would use more numbers in this case, and we can take a look at the final result. So I'll get rid of this exception throwing code, which in our case, of course, is generated by this particular line, and we'll try again. So here is the output, 10, 20, and then 1000, because we returned 30 by reference. So we returned a reference to 30, and then we use that reference to change to a different value. Of course, just like in C++, this can result in pretty disgusting use of the language. So you can write things like find more numbers, comma, 10, for example, equals 555. This is completely legal now because remember, the function invocation doesn't just return a value that you can no longer assign, but it returns a reference which you can in fact assign. So you can put an assignment statement right on the right-hand side of a function call, which isn't something that was possible up until C-sharp 7. Finally, let's take a look at some of the limitations of these ref functions and ref returns and ref locals by writing a minimum function. So I'm going to have a function which returns the minimum of two values. So it's going to be static ref int min, ref int x, and ref int y. Okay, so I want to return the minimum. Now, typically, I would use a ternary expression. So I would return if x is less than y, for example, I would return x. Otherwise, I would maybe return y, something like this. Unfortunately, this code, even though once again it's not highlighted in red, is actually invalid and will not compile. Now, what we have to do is we have to obviously return by reference, but even if I go ahead and I wrap each of these in a ref, like so, so I'll put a ref here and I put a ref here, that's not a legal syntactic construct in C-sharp 7. So unfortunately, this will not work either. Now you might be tempted to say, well, okay, I'll just put ref around the whole thing. So I will return ref and then x less than y, then x otherwise y. And this is also legal. So you cannot do this either in C-sharp 7. So the only way you can actually return the minimum of two values is to write a fully fledged if statement. So if x is less than y, return ref x, otherwise return ref y. And of course, when you come to consume this function, you're going to do a lot more refing because you have min value equals and then a min. Now, if I have, for example, int a equals 1 and b equals 2, then I would return min of ref a and ref b, and I would also have to have a ref here, and I would also have to have a ref here. So these refs, they're kind of viral. Now, interestingly enough, what you can do is if you get rid of refs on the assignment value and on the call, that's just going to give you a by-value return. So even though it feels like we're returning a reference, what happens when you take that reference and you invoke the function without the ref keyword and assign it to a value is you simply get the value. So you get the literal value copied. Whereas if we had the reference here and the reference here, then the variable min value would actually refer to the same piece of memory as the variable with the name a. So this is an example of the kind of constraints you encounter when you use these new ref keywords. C-sharp already has this idea of expression bodies, which let you shorten the bodies of methods, for example, but now the same idea has been extended to other things like constructors and getters and setters and so on. So let's imagine a peculiar scenario where you have a person, but the names are stored in a static dictionary for every single person you might have in the system. So you might have a private static read-only dictionary where you have some int identifier for a person and then you can get their name from this dictionary only. So this is quite simply a brand new dictionary from int to string, something like this, for example, and then we have the names being stored in this dictionary. So whenever you make a new person, you have to specify the ID and the name. So under the new functionality in C-sharp 7, you can have the constructor which takes the ID and the name, for example. And then what you can do is you can do an expression body. You can simply say names.add ID common name. So if it's just a single expression that you want to invoke, you can invoke it after the typical lambda arrow. And the same goes for the destructor. So if I want to have something happen when the person gets destroyed, like the name removed from the dictionary, I would say names.remove and specify the ID here as well. Of course, you have to assign the ID somewhere. So that would typically have to be like private int ID, something to that effect. Okay, so in addition to this, you can now use these expression bodies in a property. So if I want a public property for a name, what I can do is I can specify the getter. And once again, instead of doing the body with the curly braces for the get, I can specify the expression body right here. So I can return names at a particular ID. Or if I want the setter, then I can set names at a particular ID to the provided value. So these are the new possibilities in terms of expression bodies and their use in C# 7. And it's worth noting that this particular feature of C# 7 was actually contributed by the community rather than created by Microsoft. If you think about ternary expressions or null coalescing expressions, you really want both of the possible results to be of identical types. Well, in C# 7, we're kind of breaking that because now a ternary expression or a conditional null coalescing expression can actually contain a throw statement in its part. So let me show you a very simple example. So suppose I'm just going to stick to this demo class. Suppose I have a property called name. Now I want to generate a constructor which actually allows me to assign this property whenever I create a class instance of demo in this case. So I go into the code generation, I create a constructor called name, and I choose the checkbox to check the parameters for null. So when I press finish, for some reason, I get additional helpers here. So what's going on? Well, here what we're doing is we're getting the name, we're checking it for null, and if it's null, then we can throw an exception. Otherwise, we assign it. But interestingly enough, the throw statement and the assignment can be merged. So let me show you how. You can simply alt enter here and join the two together. And here is the new syntax allowed in C# 7. So in C# 7, you can use, let's say, a null coalescing expression where you check the name for null. And if it happens to be null, then instead of assigning some default value like string.empty, you simply throw an exception. And this actually works in C# 7, even though it is particularly unintuitive. Let me show you another example. Let's suppose you have just a method called getValue, which takes, let's say, int n. What you can do is you can say return, and then if n is greater than 0, then you return n plus 1. Otherwise, what you do is you throw a new exception. So once again, in a ternary exception, I can still do a throw, and this is once again completely legal in C# 7. Now you're probably wondering, well, what would happen to the value? What would happen to the actual return value if we were to do this? So let's do a simple experiment. I'll say a value equals negative 1, and then we'll do a full try catch. So what we're going to do is we're going to try and invoke getValue with an obviously negative number. So var te or var d equals new demo. So we'll make an instance of the demo class that we're working with. I'll just put an empty name in here. And then I would say v equals and say d.getValue with negative 1. So in this case, the return value is really undefined because we're just throwing, we're not returning anything. And then in the finally block, so let's put the finally block here, we're going to right line the actual value. We're going to see what the value is. I mean, is it going to be minus 1 or is it maybe going to be assigned some default value? So what is the end result here? Well, if I execute this, here is the actual exception body, and then I get the value negative 1. So as you can see, what happens in the case where you do actually throw an exception out of a function which is otherwise supposed to return is you don't really affect the value that was supposed to be passed in. So there is no in-between step in the ternary expression where the value might have been defaulted to 0, for example, which is pretty much what you would expect. One of the constraints of async methods prior to C# 7 was that async methods were required to return either a void or a task or a task of T. Now, what C# 7 allows us to do is to return other types, such as value type of T, for example, and this is good for preventing the allocation of a task when the result is actually already available at the time of writing. So let me show you a simple example of where that can pop up. Let's suppose you want to try and get the overall size of all the files in a particular directory. So under the old customs, you would write it as follows. You would say public static async, and you would return a task of long, and you would call it maybe get directory size with the given directory. Now here you have to handle the case where the directory is empty. So for example, if a directory dot, and let's complete it here, enumerate. So if you enumerate all the file system entries for the given directory, and if there aren't any of them, then you can simply return zero because you know there's nothing there. Now, unfortunately, this return zero would still imply the creation of a task, even though you might not actually need it. Now, here is the actual body. Assuming the directory is not zero, then you can sort of await task.run, where you would go ahead and you would actually enumerate all the entries and you would get their size. So you would maybe say something like directory.getFiles. So you would take the directory, get all the files that it is prepared to give you, recursively, of course, so search option all directories, and then for each of them, you would maybe use link to get an actual sum of all their sizes. So for any given file, you would make a new file info, and you would get the actual length of that particular file. So this is how you would implement this under C# 6 and earlier, and this is fine, except that whenever a directory is actually empty, you still imply the creation of a task, even though we're just trying to return a zero here as quickly as possible. Now, what happens in C# 7 is C# 7 lets us define custom return types on these async methods, and the main requirement is to implement the getAwaiter method. Now, one return type, which is also provided in an historical package, surprise, surprise, is the value task type. So let's go and actually let's use ReSharper in this case. So what we want to do is a very similar thing. In fact, it's almost identical, but we want to, instead of returning a task, returning a value task. So here I'm going to go and find this type on Nugget, and we're going to find a system threading tasks extension. So this is yet another Nugget package that we can install, and having installed it, we actually going to get this value task type. All right, so this value task type is designed precisely for this purpose, designed precisely for the purpose of avoiding the creation of a fully fledged task when we don't actually need it. And here what we can do is we can actually use this whole thing. So I can write line and we can use the new method. So get dir size 2 and get the directory size of ctemp, for example, and then since this is a value task, we can also get the result. And if I execute this, here is my final value. And finally, the last feature I want to mention is certain small improvements to the way you can define integral literals. So let's take a look at those. Now, the first improvement is that you can now add underscores to your variables. So I can say int a equals 1 to 3 underscore 3 to 1. So the underscores are useful for actually delimiting, for example, the millions, the thousands, and the units, but you can actually place them anywhere. And that's totally up to you. And you can also have as many underscores as you want. So here you can have 123, 3 to 1, bunch of underscores, 123 again. So all the underscores get obviously ignored by the compiler, and you're just left with the actual number. So this is purely for readability purposes. Now, obviously, you cannot do trailing underscores. So you cannot, for example, do 1, 2, 3, 4, and then a bunch of underlines at the end. And in fact, you'll get a pop-up to remove the invalid digit separators if you decide to do this kind of thing. Now, this functionality also works in hexadecimal. So I can say long h equals, and then the hexadecimal prefix ab underscore bc underscore d123ef, for example. That is also completely valid. And it also works in binary. So a new feature is being able to define binary literals. So you can say 0b1110 underscore 0100 underscore 0111, for example. So these are the last batch of improvements in C# 7 that I wanted to talk about. So let's try to summarize by listing all the features of C# 7 that we looked at in this video. So first of all, we looked at out variables, which can now be declared and used in the same location, which is very interesting. We also looked at pattern matching, and this generally reduces to two types of patterns. So first of all, you can do a type check, so you can check whether something is of a particular type, and you can also provide a variable for it to be assigned into, if that's the case. And we looked at the switch statement, where you have that same functionality, so you can make a case foo, so if the variable is of type foo, it gets assigned into the appropriate variable. And there is also the when keyword, which allows you to put additional constraints on the branch or on the case where you're trying to actually test. Then we looked at tuples, which require, unfortunately, the external nugget package for value tuple. But having made the tuples, we now have the names of the tuple elements, which can actually be preserved with an attribute if you want to export it out of a library to be consumed by somebody else. We looked at local function declarations, the fact that they're generally possible, and that the location of the function, it can be virtually anywhere in the containing function. So it's the same semantics that you have when you have a function inside a class, very similar thing. We also looked at ref locals and ref returns. So ref locals work only with simple constructs like values or arrays. They don't work with string lists or anything where you have, for example, an indexer being used. So unfortunately, there is also no real validity checks on whether the reference actually points to a reasonable location. So for example, I can reduce an array, but still keep pointing to an element that nobody else actually points to. So that's particularly interesting. And we looked at the fact that some code constructs, like for example ternary expressions, don't really work with this ref construct just yet. Then we also looked at this idea of ref returns from methods, the fact that you can pass in an array and then return a reference to an array element right from that method. We looked at the extended syntax for expression body members. We saw that they are now available on constructors, destructors, getters, and setters. We looked at the throw expression and the fact that it can now show up in things like null coalescing operators or ternary expressions. And finally, we saw the use of underscores in integers, including hexadecimal and binary literals. So with all that said, thank you for checking out this video. Please leave comments if you think I missed something out or if you have something to add. You can also reach out to me on Twitter at @dnestrook. I've added a couple of links to some of my online C#.NET courses right below this video. And I wish you the best of luck in applying C# 7 and using Visual Studio 2017 in your development practices.